Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 173, being recorded on the 5th of April, 2017, with special guest, Ellis Butterfield. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and our special guest, Ellis. And as usual, before we get started with Ellis, let's do a quick roundup on the updates in the Azure space this week. Kale and Evan, I think Evan mostly this time has put a whole bunch of updates for us to talk about. So, Evan, why don't you get started with something, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. Yeah. Let's start with the Azure multi-factor auth one, just because I think that's a really interesting combination, because we're combining on-premises with Azure, with an Azure service here. So multi-factor auth, right, is where you get the, you know, two-factor authentication, you know, when you're trying to access a resource. And that is a really common thing that you see with on-premises VPN solutions, right? So you're trying to VPN into your corporate network, and you've got some hardware device that's sitting on that edge. Well, today or previously, right, you would have had to install an on-premises multi-factor auth solution. You know, we've got one that we bought a company years ago called PhoneFactor. It became called Multi-Factor Server or MFA Server. And now what we've done is we're moving all of our stuff to Azure, to the cloud. Now we have a plugin for on-premises VPN solutions that allows you to plug it into Azure Multi-Factor Auth Service instead of server. So now you get kind of the benefits of still getting your on-premises VPN connections protected with multi-factor auth, but you don't have the dependency on an on-premises server solution anymore. You can just leverage the cloud solution.
So, Evan, I have a question about this. So, mm-hmm. And maybe I misunderstand how this works, but when I set those up long time ago, when we did site-to-site VPN, yeah. And it was a pre-shared key. And we basically would establish that key, and then that's what we used on both sides to make the connection. Where does this fit in?
So you're talking about site-to-site VPN, right? This is typically you'll see this with point-to-site type solutions.
I see.
Right.
I see.
So I'm an individual wanting to VPN into my corporate network, mm-hmm. right? In that case, you don't have a pre-shared key, right? You have just your credentials or whatever authentication you've got, but it's still single factor.
I see.
This allows you to layer on the two-factor auth, which everybody wants these days.
That's great.
Yeah, Kale, you know, I like to think of it. You remember the old RSA keys that we used to have,
yep.
The little key fobs? And that used to be our multi-factor authentication, right?
Yep.
You'd enter a password or a PIN number, and then it would ask for that number as well, that constantly changed every 1 minute. But that required this very expensive and probably, you know, elaborate setup on premises of this RSA server that does all the fancy, you know, encryption and all that stuff. Now you don't need that. That's really, I think, the point of this is Microsoft offers that service in the cloud. So you can have your VPN server online on premises, but the actual multi-factor authentication can be provided by Azure.
Right.
That's
yeah.
Great.
Just a little, basically a little shim on premises in tied tucked into your, you know, actually integrated in with your VPN solution. And then, you know, now you can turn around and use that with the Azure MFA service. Right. So you lose that on premises, you know, software and hardware dependency.
I'm actually unfamiliar with the service. I'm sorry to butt in here. Is this a generic service or is this specifically for VPNs?
So Azure Multi-Factor Auth is generic. It applies really anywhere where you've got an authentication coming in. So, you know, you've probably you work in the cloud space like the rest of us, and you probably two-factor auth yourself. I don't know how many times a day.
300 times.
that's the multi-factor auth solution. So anywhere where you've got authentication coming through, you can layer in that multi-factor auth, and the service is part of what's integrated with, like, when you've got the authentication app on your phone, right, mm-hmm. where you get the phone call, or you get the PIN request, whatever it is, mm-hmm. all that's tying back into the service.
Mm, okay. Yeah, simple MFA is really, really handy if you're doing any kind of web development too. So I was just thinking about that from my previous experience trying to do auth for users with web development. It's a pain.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think it is directly integrated with our Azure B2C offering as well, right?
It actually sits. I'm not 100% sure.
The Active Directory offering.
Yeah, exactly. It's sitting at the Azure Active Directory level. So I haven't actually looked at BDC in this scenario, but I can't imagine why it wouldn't, because it's really one layer lower,
right
in that stack. So I would expect it to.
Good. That's a good one. Cale, what do you want to talk about?
So last time I was on, we didn't have any blockchain updates, so we do have one this time. So I'll have to bring that one forward. This is one for me, actually. I posted this one last week, Syscoin, at the end of last week. Syscoin is a new partner that we've kind of joined the Azure ecosystem with us. They have a whole kind of suite of tools up there to do their processing, and they have multiple different kind of use cases that they're filling. They're part of this product called Blockchain Foundry. It's a pretty nice product, and we welcome them to the Azure space with, I think they have three different offerings up there right now.
Very nice. Surely you guys are getting a lot of partners, and I know it's a hot space. There's for a long time, there's some update on the Azure Service Bus feature. And as you know, that's kind of it's like a queuing facility built into Azure, like more of an enterprise queuing facility, very robust that lets you send messages up and down. But there's always been an issue if you were sitting behind a firewall, for example, because if you wanted to get that real-time connectivity, you had to use something called a relay, and the relay was typically using WCF-based protocols. And, that's kind of limiting to Windows, so you really couldn't have a Linux system that that could participate in that. And now with the new feature, the Azure Service Bus Hybrid Connections feature that's for Azure Relay, that's generally available, and that allows you to use WebSockets or just REST APIs, essentially, to provide that behind the firewall connectivity to Azure Service Bus. So that
functionally just opens it up to everybody at that point, once you're using WebSockets and SSL at that point.
It opens it up to everyone. It opens it up to other languages, right? There's all these other advantages that come to removing that dependency from WCF. The WCF thing is obviously still there and will be supported for as long as, the framework is around, but now there is this additional option of using, the WebSockets.
That's Service Bus. It's like one of the grandfathers of Azure, right? I mean, it's been there forever.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, it's probably one of the first, if not the first, that was out there. I mean, it was.
Well, it was originally a Windows, an on-premises server offering.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
If you remember, and I think it was part of the App Fabric product
yep.
that we used to make available for a free download, and now that's all in the in Azure. So yeah, definitely one of the more robust services we have out there.
Yep.
What else?
So I'm going to call out this one just because we're coming up on an important date. We were talking about Azure AD, so DirSync, which is the original Azure AD. Synchronization appliance, and then Azure AD Sync, which is kind of a short-lived one, was on just for a couple of years, have been superseded by Azure AD Connect. That's our appliance for synchronizing from your on-premises directory to Azure Active Directory. Those are both deprecated effective next week, April 13th, and so they're moving into end of support. We will still help you upgrade, but if you're trying to do something with those old tools, we're going to require that you upgrade before we dig into your problem again. Those, you really shouldn't be on those anyways. I mean, we've put in a ton of improvements, with Azure AD Connect, and my team actually deals with these upgrades, and 99.99% of the time, it is a seamless move from DirSync and Azure AD Sync. So it really is kind of a good thing to do anyway. But, if you haven't done it yet, you need to make plans to it, because before too long, we won't talk to you until after you upgrade.
So there's no loss in fidelity, right, if you upgrade?
You actually probably gain.
I'm sure you do, yeah.
Yeah. There shouldn't be anything that you lose, moving from one to the other.
Great.
And to be clear, it's not like 13th your Active Directory is going to get deleted or something. It's more of a. We want you to, and we won't support it. Like from
And synchronization will still work if you. But if you call for support, we're going to make you upgrade. Versus today, we kind of encourage you to, but we're not going to force you till after the 13th. So.
Okay. Great, Kale. You want anything that catches your eye there?
I guess the other one that caught my eye was around DocDB with the MongoDB being GA. So now that it's essentially an API that sits in front of DocDB to kind of emulate Mongo I guess it's GA now. So it has the same SLAs as DocumentDB, fully supported, all that stuff now. So that's goodness for anybody out there that's migrating workloads using Mongo to use our DocDB as a backend.
Okay. Yeah, and also in that same DocDB vein, they've also added aggregate support now. So, you know, like doing count, minimum, those kind of SQL, min, max, average, etc. Those kind of functions are now available in DocDB. They've also made an emulator available as a Docker image, like a DocDB emulator, so you can spin up your own little.
That's awesome. Yeah. I didn't know about that. That's really cool.
Yeah, that looks pretty interesting, actually. And then they've also done some integration with Azure Search, you know, to be able to allow Azure Search to, I guess, index your DocDB documents.
That emulator thing is really cool. I don't know what the limitations are. I don't know. Do you know much about that, Sajid?
No, I don't, unfortunately, but I will be trying it out now that I've read about it.
Yeah, because the big thing there was always like, I mean, not that it's a super costly service, but it does cost to run those. And if you could run maybe, I don't know, the VM's obviously going to cost to run it, but I'm just wondering if when you're just developing.
Well, they had, I do recall they had a DocDB that integrated that you could run on your machine. Right, I think that was always available, like on a dev machine.
I see.
Now they're making it. I think they packaged it up to run in the
Docker
container as well. Yeah. And just a quick mention about the L series. I think we kind of talked about this at maybe just 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was just in preview at that time. So they went very quickly to generally available. This is the low latency version of Azure VMs. I think we had made a mention how they could be used for things like, you know, running your own MongoDB or other NoSQL workloads that require low latency. And those are not generally available.
That was fast.
Right on. Yeah. What else? Anything else you want to talk about here? There was an Azure SQL database here for the 4TB option. What is that in the P11 and P15 databases?
They just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. I don't know. Ellis, do you have any insight into this?
To be frank, not really. I'm actually learning a lot listening to you.
Okay. No worries. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, it's okay. I get pretty swamped just dealing with DW, so I don't necessarily know what's going on with the rest of the ecosystem. Unless, of course, it directly pertains to DW. So.
Yeah, and this is now you see why the three of us got involved in this in the first place, because we walk away with stuff ourselves every week. So.
And to that point, I got a funny story that Evan will appreciate. I was in the UK a couple of days ago, and we were doing something, and this guy gets up and says, oh, he starts talking about on-premise stuff. And then he stopped, and I said, I think you mean on-premises. Then he just looked at me, you know.
Excellent. Like, thank you very much for now. Thank you very much for fighting the good fight here, Kale. I appreciate it.
It is so ingrained in me from being around Evan now that I look for it now when people start talking about great connections.
Excellent. Right. I'm going to get a hate mail from that, whoever it was that was up talking.
So cool. Just a couple of other quick ones over here. I think Azure HD Insight is now available in additional regions. I didn't know West US 2 never had Azure HD Insight, which was kind of surprising. I thought it always was, you know, I guess.
Yeah.
The Azure HD Insight for Linux is now available in Central India region. So they're kind of rolling that out, obviously. And then the Azure Advisor is now generally available. This was in preview prior before this, and that's the one that offers. It's a free service that's offered to everybody. It kind of, you know, you can allow it to look at your configuration, your resource setup, and usage, and it makes kind of also the recommendations for you, how to get better, higher availability, how to improve your security, performance, cost effectiveness, etc. And it's a free resource. I definitely recommend everyone should do that first before calling into Evan.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Don't call me after. Call me, or I'm sorry, call me after you've tried that stuff.
There you go. All right, so I think that's a good roundup with all the news. Thanks, guys, for jumping in, and Alice as well. So let's turn over to our special guest, Alice. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for our listeners.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely. So my name is Alice Hiroki Butterfield. I'm a program manager for SQL Data Warehouse, and I'm on the control plane feature team. So I am the PM in charge of a lot of the CRUD operations and managing deployments.
Yeah, so for our audience, you may want to define some of those acronyms. And what you mean by data plane as well.
Oh, yeah, so absolutely. So the control plane is basically our distributed management service, I guess you could call it. So when a user creates a new data warehouse, or they update it, or they pause or resume or use any of our functionality like scale, it's the service layer that manages making sure that everything starts up correctly, that the nodes are connected all right, and that when an upgrade goes out, that it's not impactful, or if it is impactful, that the nodes come back up quickly. And it also is a service that provisions the various compute nodes for when you scale up and scale down.
Okay, great, cool.
Now, we obviously have this on the on-premises version of SQL Server. And I think in the past we've talked about some of the cadence that, you know, the on-premises code takes versus the cloud code. How does that work for data warehouse?
So we have a variety of different updates that go out. So there's a couple code bases that constitute updates, and we have two various types of updates. So there's impactful deployments and silent deployments. So a lot of users are getting updates just all the time. But most people wouldn't know about it because, I guess those would be classified as unimpactful deployments. And, that's actually handled by a different team. I think what we're talking about, the different ways that things get updated.
How it compares to the on-premises version of the product, right? In terms of keeping them in sync, and things like that, the actual code base itself.
Yeah, okay, sorry. I don't actually have too much experience with how on-premise updates happen. I know that people basically manage the updates themselves. In the DW space, the way it works is we have basically trains that go out and do updates. So we have the silent ones, which have the updates. We have various code bases that go out at different times. So under the hood, SQL Data Warehouse runs the SQL Server engine. In a distributed fashion, but nonetheless, it's a SQL Server engine. So we get those updates as those come out, but then we also rely on various other updates, such as the Service Fabric updates, which manages the topologies of the network, as well as our own DW engines and the PDW engine, which you might remember from, if you guys are familiar with APS, it's also the code base from APS. And so those all actually come at different times. So it's not like there's like, even though every 6 months is generally when features come out, the updates themselves can happen anytime between those 6 months. And that's generally how it goes. So teams kind of work on different cadences, depending on the complexity of their problem. And so that can sometimes lead to really longer deployments for customers. So that's something we're trying to work out right now, where if we like a lot of features are coming out all of a sudden, then the upgrades are really batched. And that can sometimes be problematic. And as far as updates go for customers, it doesn't actually happen globally. So it's not like we flip a switch and have the entire world change the new bits. We actually go through regions, region by region. And so an interesting way that we handle updates is we use SQL Server engine code, and it is in our documentation, but we also use SQL DB. So we're built off of SQL DB as well. And so the nice thing is when SQL DB, updates their stuff and they get bigger and faster, we actually get bigger and faster too, to some degree, depending. But so basically we have a main train that goes out and those do those updates, and then we wait to see how those are doing, and then we can update our own at a different schedule. So we're somewhat sheltered from the rest of the world when it comes to updates, which is to provide users a bit more safety when it comes to updates, because with data warehousing and big workloads, you don't want to be interrupting your users' workload as much.
So what you're kind of getting at there is, right, I mean, when we talk about these PaaS services in general, right, the platform as a service services, they tend to, you just see the upgrades under the covers all the time. It's really transparent to a customer. They don't know or they don't care. What you're getting at here is because it sounds like it's because the nature of the workload that your end users are doing is the long running activities. You really can't completely operate in that fashion, right? You have to be a little bit more cognizant of those. And so you're kind of careful of which pieces and parts you upgrade when. Is that kind of the right way to interpret what you described there?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, it's still a problem that we deal with, because while we try to minimize the amount of downtime customers do perceive, and we try to do it in the most during times we see deployments as being activity being the lowest, we still run into the issue of, you know, if only one customer happens to be doing, I mean, this is a bit of a gross example, but if only one customer is doing something at a given time and we happen to roll an impactful deployment and it happens to hit that one customer who is doing a huge load job, they get really angry at us, understandably. So this is actually something we're working on right now as we speak. So it's not something that's fully fleshed out yet, but we hope to move towards a future where customers can get more transparency with the service. So I guess with managed services, in an ideal world, updates happen instantly and they don't impact customers. But I think in the world of OLAP and big workloads, that's not entirely feasible. So the next step is actually, instead of saying, oh, we'll do it under the covers, say, these are the times we will be doing it and we'll try to impact you the least. And this is how you work around some instability or upgrades that might be happening during your working hours.
That's so interesting to me, you know, as somebody, so I was involved with SQL Azure when it first launched. I remember that was something that we really kind of, you know, we were immature as a service, so I'm not going to totally blame customers here, you know, but we really worked hard and told customers, hey, you have to have retry logic and, you know, you have to have increased timeouts and all those kind of things. And we obviously did a lot to make sure the service itself was stable. But at the end of the day, you were a long SQL query was still something that ran for a minute, right? Which is trivial compared to what you guys are doing in a data warehouse scenario, right? You're talking significantly longer timescales, right? So retry is really not an option when your job takes 2 hours, right, or 3 hours.
Yeah. And so we kind of inherit a lot of the assumptions that SQLDB made when it comes to updating and updating customer instances. And, you know, in a way, we're really thankful that we can move as fast as we can because we inherited a lot of really good engineering. But as I said before, some of those assumptions don't really work super well with SQL DW. Yep. And so it's just a constant problem we've having. And as a relatively immature service, and we only really GA'd mid last year, there are a lot of problems, or I shouldn't say problems, but there are a lot of challenges working with big enterprise customers with their expectations of resiliency, availability, and transparency. And yeah, it's problems that you don't necessarily have when your queries are running under a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. So I heard you mention in there PDW/APS, right, which is kind of the on-premises parallel, you know, usually PDW came from parallel data warehouse, right? Mm-hmm. Is your service the cloud version of that? I mean, it sounds like it runs on top of it to some degree. Is this actually the kind of the next step of that product sitting in the cloud?
No, I wouldn't say that. What I was trying to get to was SQL DW moved really quickly into GA by taking a lot of good code from a lot of different mature services. And so some of that came from the on-premise system that existed before it.
Gotcha.
That was why the code bases that exist can come from a variety of sources, and that's why they don't all get updated in one big fashion, but kind of roll out depending on when features and changes are deployed to those specific repositories.
Gotcha. So I kind of know SQL PW, you know, and kind of get help me understand what SQL Data Warehouse, like what it is, what it does. You know, why does a customer want it other than, you know, they have a large data set?
Well, I mean, functionally, it's different than a database, right? So if you have I guess it would be the same reason any customer would want a Teradata system or a larger Greenplum or Redshift, right? So you have a lot of data and you need to analyze it. And so it's like it's functionally not the same as, you know, a database where it's transactional and you need to get, you know, you have your singleton reads or you have your high reads, high writes.
Right.
It's when you are getting into many, many terabytes of data and you need to analyze it. Like, I guess from a customer's perspective, we actually have interesting scenarios where customers are using kind of a weird, I wouldn't say weird, but an interesting hybrid use of OLAP. So something that you wouldn't normally consider OLAP model, but where we really shine is when you're trying to do large, large historical analyses, ad hoc analyses. I think that's really where data warehouse shines currently. So I guess to be a little bit more specific, we only have a concurrency limit of 32. And so for many customers, this comes as a surprise given other systems which have higher concurrency models. And it's something we're working towards increasing in the future. But the really big thing with our system is that it's really powerful, but it's also something that needs to be highly tuned. And so as a managed service, it's something that we always kind of have it's something that we have to work out every time we come up with new features is to what level of managed service do customers want. So on one hand, you can go kind of the BigQuery model where you hyper manage everything for the customer and then they just kind of slide a counter to get their performance. But a lot of people coming from SQL Server backgrounds, they really want to be able to tune and understand what's going on with their system. And so that plays a lot of part into our system.
So the concurrency is, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Sujeet.
No, I just want to clarify something that Alice said earlier. So you said this is not really meant for transactional data. So I understand then that you somehow have to bulk load. You're mostly querying data, right, in SQL Data Warehouse. So how do you get the data in there is, I guess, what I wanted to do. And I don't know if you're going to cover it later, but like, how do you get that big, you know, multi-terabytes of data into SQL Server Data Warehouse in the first place?
So, I mean, I think the general advice we give to customers is to use Polybase, which is our, I shouldn't say our loading mechanism because, you know, people coming from SQL Server might interpret that incorrectly. So despite the name, Polybase used with SQL DW is quite a different beast than Polybase used with SQL Server. It's not meant to do push down computation to other services. It's actually just used as a parallel loader. So the way Polybase works with SQL DW is if you split even very large amounts of data into sizable chunks so that Polybase can parallelize the loads, it will actually it'll parallelize the loads straight into the 60 distributions as opposed to the it's through the compute nodes into the 60 distributions as opposed to going through the head node. So just a little bit high level, I didn't actually talk about this. So SQL Data Warehouse is an MPP system, right? So we have a scaling number of computational nodes you can have attached to your storage layer. And so with other forms of loading like bulk copy, you're going to be going through the head node. But with Polybase, you actually go through each of the compute nodes. So you actually have an entire node devoted to loading your data in. So that can actually be quite fast, much faster than conventional loading products.
Got it. Thank you. I'm sorry, Evan. Yeah, you were going to ask a question?
Yeah, no, I was just the comment about concurrency. That's basically what you're talking about the parallelism that you're able to implement from a query perspective, right? Is up, you set up to, I think, 32, right?
Yeah, 32 concurrent queries. I was actually trying to make a point that sometimes customers think about, or they come into the service thinking that it's just a large database. So they think that they can hammer the system with a bunch of users running a bunch of small queries.
Right.
And so with the concurrent query limitation, they often somewhat get confused as to why they don't get their queries as fast, and it's because their queries end up getting queued. And it's because the system is really optimized for doing really big, big analysis, analytical queries, and not the OLTP sometimes people come into expecting.
Right. So not a whole bunch of, you know, 50 or 100 or a couple hundred parallel small ones. You're talking, you know, up to 32 really big ones that are going to run for a long time, those individual queries.
Yeah. And part of it comes from the fact that the way the system was engineered is we try to give the enough memory for each concurrent query so that it can really be optimal in its performance. And so, you know, it's a trade-off between the number of users that can be using it and the memory you can give them. So, yeah.
Okay. No, so, that's good.
So let me understand how this works then. So you said the query goes into the head node first, and then is that how it works? And then that kind of shreds it or something like that, and then distributes it with all the other nodes. How does that work?
Yeah, so your query goes in through the head node, and then we have a so you write your generic T-SQL, and so we have a pretty good T-SQL surface area. It's not perfect, but we have quite a lot there. And so the head node will then we have a distributed query optimizer that will take that query and distribute it across the amount of compute nodes that you have provisioned, and then it will push down that to each of the compute nodes. The compute nodes will get their results and push them back to the head node.
And the head node then aggregates all the results back. Is that how it works?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, I mean, obviously we draw a lot of correlation to how something like Hadoop would work, right? Is it similar in the sense that each node is working on a smaller set of data, or how's that? I mean, I don't know if that's too detailed or too proprietary, but if there's anything you could share on that, that'd be great.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's actually in our documentation, so feel free to check it out anytime. So the way it works, it's slightly different than Hadoop. So, and you might have to correct me because I'm not super familiar with Hadoop, but with Hadoop, the storage and the compute are coupled, if I understand that correctly.
Right.
Generally, so when you provision a large number of Hadoop nodes, you might have redundancy of data between the nodes, but then the nodes themselves contain both the compute resources and the storage. The way it works for SQL DW is we have 60 distributions which constitute the remote storage layer, and so a compute node gets a fraction, so each compute node that you provision gets a fraction of that remote storage layer to work on. That's how we decouple compute and storage. So at the lowest range, you know, there's a DW100, which is pretty much, it's not SMP, but if you're running a DW100, it's mostly for development, right? So you are not really getting any of the benefits of parallelism. But anyway, that single compute node will attach to all 60 of the remote distributions. And so it will handle all of the data in and out and the processing for the 60 distributions. And say if you were to go to DW400, which is four compute nodes, then each of the compute nodes will split that 16 to four. So each one will get 15. And then finally, at the highest end, we have the 6,000, which each compute node will be getting each of the slices of data individually. And so that's why that can be the fastest.
Got it. Thank you.
So what, you know, there's a lot of, you know, when I talk to our customers and, you know, they're using some product on premises, you talked about Teradata and some of the other ones that are out there, and that this is, you know, kind of has similar, you know, capabilities, you know, in terms of kind of what they're doing. What is it that drives these customers to go from, you know, the on-premises solutions to the cloud solution? Is it just the you know, removing the management headaches? Are there some kind of really unique features that we're able to offer because this is a cloud platform? Or, you know, what's the driver for customers to go, hey, check this out and try this?
Yeah, so I think it's a couple of factors. I think one you touched on was the total cost of ownership. So, you know, anytime you have an on-premises system, you have IT and you have management and you have development resources that you need to expend towards, you know, increasing or improving or even just the routine maintenance of the system. So that's one of them. Another big thing I think is just the Azure ecosystem as a whole. So customers don't come, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of large enterprise customers don't come onto Azure because there's one specific product that is incredibly appealing to them. Usually it's a investment in Azure itself. And SQL DW just plays a large role in that oftentimes because large enterprise customers have to migrate their on-premise data warehouses. And I think there is something to be said about the speed at which managed cloud services get developed versus on-premise systems, which is something that companies both like and dislike. So an interesting thing is that a lot of enterprises are somewhat wary of fast updating. So, and this could just be because of the speed at which corporations move or just their familiarity with certain development cycles. But I think it also helps, though, with when, you know, anytime there's security updates or anytime there's just features that, you know, they're absolutely waiting for, it's much faster to happen. It's much faster in the cloud than it is on premise.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. No. I mean, I'm in support. So, you know, what I typically hear from customers is to, you know, kind of to your point, right? It's a mix of things. I think what I have tended to find customers evolving to is they on premises, there was this perception that if I just set it up and leave it alone, it doesn't change, so it won't break. The reality is the OS, the network, the data, all that stuff is changing all of the time. And some of the customers I hear that, or I work with that are kind of a little bit more cognizant of just because I don't touch a system doesn't mean it's static. Those are the ones that I find that are a little bit more comfortable with cloud, right? Because they understand that it is a changing ecosystem by definition, and they see the value of those changes. You know, again, understanding that even if they wanted it, their on-premises environment to be static, it's not, right? It's a little bit of an illusion at that point.
Yeah. And even with the, even with on-premises, like the idea of not breaking, as soon as, you know, data is always increasing, right? It's just inevitable. The data growth is just unimaginably large right now, and it will continue. So, you know, the hardware you buy this year will soon no longer be able to meet your demands in the future. And part of being in the cloud is that, you know, we have to keep our performance in parity or better than all of the competition. So everybody's always going to be increasing their performance and their hardware under the hood. And so it makes that process much easier. And as you said, right, as soon as you change one bit of hardware on an on-premise system, you know, or that static, that staticness that you wanted, the non-breakability is already out the door.
Yep. Yeah. I, you know, I was on the SQL Server on-premises team for a long time and, you know, always loved the cases with customers, but I didn't change anything. Well, you're right, but you kept adding data and more data and more data, and eventually your system just couldn't handle it, right, the way that you design stuff. That is one of the benefits of the cloud world, right? The infrastructure underneath, we are always upgrading, right? So you're abstracted from some of that.
I had a couple questions too. The one question I had was around like security and like features. Is there like feature parity between this and just like a traditional Azure SQL database or even on-premises version, like from a, I don't know, I'm just thinking about like TDE and things like that that people might use for sensitive data that's in a warehouse.
Mm-hmm. So I believe we have TDE. I'm not super savvy on what security options that we currently offer. What I can say is, as far as parity goes, I wouldn't say that we are close to SQLDB or SQL Server parity in terms of feature area in ways that customers might sometimes expect. And part of it comes from the fact that, you know, we're a relatively new service, but also because there's always this trade-off between, you know, there are some features that are core critical features for a customer. And so, you know, clearly we have to have parity with those. And then there are other features that are kind of nice, right? Especially, this is especially the case with language features, right? And so when you consider development time, a lot of times there's these performance or, you know, table stakes features or even just ones that make us more competitive that we end up focusing on. And sometimes we don't have that engineering to, you know, meet all, like, to completely fulfill that surface area. And I don't think that will ever happen. I think we'll get close, but I suspect at the rate at which we develop features specifically for customers' big data cases, that gap will probably grow slightly larger over time.
Yeah, I would assume that like these are more specialized type workloads, right? You're not using this as a general purpose database. This is designed, like as you mentioned before, for like even the way the query engine has been tuned or whatnot for this, for these really long or pulling back lots of data on these analytics type queries. So that's cool. The other question I had is around the compute side. We kept mentioning about compute nodes. Is there like anyway, from like a customer standpoint, that they're able to see like even telemetry and stuff off of those things or like their compute nodes or anything, because it is kind of like a PaaS type service for them. So how do they, are they able to see into that at all, or are they just strictly based on query performance and things like that from a tuning standpoint?
So from a tuning standpoint, there's kind of abstract ways you can tune it by making sure, you know, your distribution, the amount of data distributed on the distributions are relatively even, that you don't have too much data movement, which you can tell from your query plans. But to your point about telemetry, like CPU or memory or IO, currently we don't expose any of that. And actually, it's been a major customer ask for us. So we're actually working towards that end to make the making understanding performance tuning a little bit easier. So yeah, that kind of brings up the question of I mentioned earlier about how much managed should we be for customers. And I think it's something that we've learned that customers don't necessarily want the sliding bar. They actually want to know what's going on in the hood because people are accustomed to performance tuning. And so it's something we're working towards. But to answer your point, no, we don't currently have telemetry that gives a really good picture of how to tune your data warehouse right now based on the compute node.
But you can still, like you said, using the query tuning features and things like that, they can still use that to kind of gauge how things are running and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can take a semi-large data set, and generally you should experience about linear increases in performance or decreases depending on what direction you're going in CTAS statements and scans. Mm-hmm. So in aggregates, right? But the real point of contention with an MPP data warehouse, so of any kind of MPP data warehouse, is when you're doing joins, and if you haven't properly written your query, or your data is not distributed well, then you incur a lot of the cost of data movement service, which kind of reduces the performance benefits of parallelism. And so that's something that customers occasionally struggle with, and it's something that we have to work towards making better, either through transparent documentation, which gives good advice on how to make your thing, write your queries better, or managing more of that under the hood for customers.
And then the last question I had was around performance, was like the scaling features you were talking about. So if I can scale kind of the...
That was going to be my question, systems. Yeah. Good
oh,
one.
Sorry, go ahead, Sajid.
No, same one. It's like, yeah, ask it.
Yeah, I was just wondering, how... is that, something that could be automated? Like, I think about, websites and things like that, where we can put certain metrics in there and say, if I see this go above X percentage over a period of time, then it means I need to add another instance. In this case, it's going between tiers and whatnot. Is that something that could be automated, or how does that work from a scale up, scale down thing?
So as far as auto pause resume and auto scaling functionality, it's not something that's currently built on where we kind of see your activity or see your performance and do the scaling or pausing resuming for you. Mm-hmm. But the operations themselves are exposed through REST APIs. And also for scaling, not pause and resume, but for scaling. So some people always get confused with this and wonder why it doesn't exist. For reasons that aren't explained here, you can't actually scale within T-SQL, so through SSMS. And so generally customers might, for instance, two examples might be you have a big load time, so you'll scale up, then you'll load a bunch of data, then you'll scale it down. For the reasons I mentioned before with parallelism and polybase and compute nodes. Another thing is, customers might have the opposite. So they have their peak business hours. They know they're going to be running a lot of queries. They might have an automated process that will scale up at the beginning of the day and then scale back down at the end of the day, or maybe even pause the instance to save money. Managed operations, such as what you mentioned with auto scale and auto pause and resumes, are always things we're looking into and things we're trying to figure out whether or not this really would help the customers.
Nice. So currently, how do you move from one of those node sizes to another? Can you do that?
Yeah. It's just go on your portal, and there's a little dragging slider, and you go, I want to 500, 600, 6,000. You just scale it up, hit save, or go.
And your data, everything remains, if there's operations in flight, that all gets taken care of, everything as it does.
No, that's actually, thank you for bringing that up. That was a good point. So your data warehouse will always stay in a consistent state, right? And so part of the problem is for customers, if you have queries in flight and you try to do a pause or a scale, then we have to, return your system to a stable state. And so currently the infrastructure, or currently the way we have it is, the connections are killed, and then we roll back all of the transactions that are in flight. And so that sometimes this isn't, customers aren't aware of this sometimes, and so what they'll do is they'll have a very long running query, then they will scale, or they'll pause, or in the middle, and so then we have to roll back the transaction, which actually makes the operation take even longer. And so from a customer's perspective, they're really confused as to why the operation that usually took a couple minutes might take much more than that, and it's because we're rolling back the transaction. But that is a problem area we're aware of and something we're working on.
Thank you for clarifying that. That's very good. All right. We've already gone on for quite a bit on this topic, and I guess there's so much to talk about. I thought it was going to be like a
It's big data,
relatively
Sajid. It's big data. You get, of course.
But I think Ellis put in some good spin on some of the conversation, which was very nice. Well, any more questions for Ellis before we wrap up over here?
No, this is good. You were laughing at the beginning, Ellis, that you learned stuff from us. I now actually understand, some of what SQL DW or SQL Azure DW is. I thought I understood it, but I clearly didn't. So I appreciate you coming in to share the information.
Same here. Yeah, this has been very educational. Thanks so much, Ellis, for
Yeah, well,
sharing.
It was my pleasure. There's always our documentation. If you have any other questions, if there's something that's not there and you're curious, put it in the comments, because I'm the one who gets yelled at when those don't get answered, which, by the way, there are a couple. So just keep that in mind. I'm a little bit behind. But it was my pleasure having a conversation. And just ask me questions anytime, my email. So,
sure. Thanks
Sounds
a lot.
Great.
Alice.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.